But in terms of evolution, it may have been one of the first reasons, perhaps even the most important one. This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by William Oram, with help from Joseph Farley in psychological and brain sciences. I'm Yael Cassander.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
In sports headlines this afternoon, the NFL has announced that for the third straight year, a regular season game will take place in London. The game in Wembley Stadium next season will feature the New England Patriots and Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Bucs will be listed as the home team, giving up a game in Tampa. The Houston Texans are playing host to the Jacksonville Jaguars in tonight's NFL game. Each club enters the game tied for last place in the AFC South with 4 wins and 7 losses. University of Illinois volleyball coach Don Harden will retire at the end of the season following 21 years as a head coach, the last 13 at Illinois. He also served 5 years as an assistant coach for the Illini. Over the course of those years, he's participated in 9 of Illinois' 17 NCAA appearances, including a Final Four appearance in 1987. This year, the team won 13 of its last 16 matches. It's received a bid to the 2008 NCAA Women's Volleyball Tournament and will host the first and second round matches at Huff Hall. Illinois center Mike Tisdale shares Big Ten Player of the Week honors this week with Purdue guard Etwan Moore. Tisdale is a 7-1 sophomore who was named MVP at the South Padre Invitational. The Illini, 6-0, won the Thanksgiving weekend tournament with victories over Kent State and Tulsa. Tisdale had a career-high 20 points against Kent State and 12 against Tulsa. Moore averaged 20.5 points a game in the semifinal and final of the Dick's Sporting Goods NIT season tip-off. The 10th-ranked Boilermakers lost the final to number 11 Oklahoma. Purdue is 5-1 on the season. The NCAA tournament is months away, but Illinois coach Bruce Weber says this week could mean a lot to the Illini's postseason ambitions. Illinois faces Clemson on Tuesday night in Champaign and Georgia on Saturday in Chicago. Weber calls unranked Clemson one of the tougher, faster teams the Illini will face this season. The Tigers are 7-0 and, like Illinois, starting to get some top 25 votes. Georgia is coming off an NCAA tournament appearance, but the 5-1 Bulldogs are not ranked and lost key players off that team. And in college basketball action tonight, Northwestern opens a 4-game homestand with a matchup against UC Riverside. Tonight's game is the start of a 3-games-and-6-days stretch for the Wildcats. Northwestern is 3-1 so far this year, while the Highlanders are 4-1. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois, hosting a lifelong learning program developed specifically for adults over 50. Additional information on programs available at 244-9141.
It's 2:44. Nations along the Red Sea are calling for military intervention to end the growing number of pirate attacks. One of the countries most concerned is Egypt, which operates the Suez Canal. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Cairo.
The 75% increase in pirate attacks off the coast of Somalia this year set off alarm bells in Cairo. The Suez Canal is Egypt's third largest source of income, and when 3 shipping companies ordered some of their vessels to travel around the Cape of Good Hope rather than risk the passage through the Suez, Egypt's anxiety took on a fresh urgency. Egypt says it's prepared for military action against the pirates, either alone or as part of a multinational force. The head of the Suez Canal Authority said revenue did dip this fall from last year's record levels, but he added that sending supertankers around Africa is a costly and time-consuming alternative, so he believes the canal will remain the first option so long as security can be maintained. Russian, Indian, American, and European naval vessels are already patrolling the shipping lanes, but so far nations have been reluctant to blockade the Somali coast. One suspected pirate ship destroyed by the Indian Navy turned out to be a Thai-owned fishing boat that had been seized by pirates. Another solution to the piracy problem, some officials say, would be to restore the rule of law to the failed state of Somalia. But so far, no one has stepped forward with an effective plan to accomplish that. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Cairo.
America has a new flirtation with nuclear power. Utility companies are fanning out across the nation to set up shop, and they've given the government more applications for new nuclear plants than they have for decades. Many towns fell under the spell of nuclear power in the past, but some power plants stopped running decades earlier than planned, and towns are stuck with what's left behind. In the first of a two-part series on the legacy of nuclear power, Sean Ali profiles one town's tarnished relationship with nuclear power.
Irene and Ray Zuckley have been together so long, they finish each other's sentences, especially when I ask how things were in Zion, Illinois, back in the 1960s.
The factories were going, they were getting downgraded, you know.
What were those?
Well, it was the curtain factory, the cookie factory, and chocolates, and then we had the Zion fig bars.
But just then, the power company said it would spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a nuclear power plant. Irene Zuckley says most people welcomed it.
Ray and I never worried about it. You know, we just wanted progress. When you think of having taxes lowered for everybody in Zion, it made you feel what else would come in and do that.
Irene and Ray Zuckley were forced to sell their family's beach cottage to make room for Zion Reactor Number 1. Beachfront neighbors did the same. But like the Zuckleys predicted, taxes and jobs rolled into Zion. It was supposed to be a 40-year windfall, but it didn't last. When you visit the power plant now, it's mostly empty.
What you've got here is what used to be a full-fledged control
room. Ron Schuster runs what's left of the Zion nuclear power plant. Once, the power plant had more than 800 employees. Now, Schuster and about 50 workers help manage the regional power grid. They also monitor radioactive spent fuel waste. The generators have been offline since 1997.
There was large pieces of equipment essential to make an electricity that would have needed needed total replacement going forward, and we're talking significant dollars. So that's where the economic decision was made by the board of directors that Zion Station would go into a safe store mode.
That means the power plant and the city of Zion have been in limbo for 10 years. The radioactive fuel is still on site, but the plant provides no power, few jobs, and a fraction of the property taxes. Delaine Rogers is Zion's economic development director. She says the town didn't plan on this.
You're in a community that has welcomed you. We, you know, haven't had an antagonistic relationship. They're not going to close, but they did. And it took $17 million of our local revenues. We were facing losing all of our arts and music and sports in our schools. How do you fund police department? How do you fix potholes? It was a very, very scary time.
Lately, the power company has gone back and forth about when it will decommission or dismantle the power plant. It could be done 10 years from now, or it could take decades more. But even when most of the buildings are gone, there's still the radioactive spent fuel.
They're just going to leave it. And then they're going to put a football-sized concrete pad filled with casks of stored fuel on site, above ground. Tell me how you get a private developer to think residential or retail. I'm not buying the first condo.
Dozens of towns are stuck in relationships with dormant nuclear power plants. Delaine Rogers says the town of Zion is in the same position. She won't call it a bad relationship, but she says it sure would be nice to know exactly where it's going or when it will be over. For The Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about The Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
In rural Washington state, people gathered this weekend to celebrate the country's most famous unsolved hijacking. 37 years ago, a man known as D.B. Cooper seized a jetliner, received a ransom, and parachuted somewhere over the southwestern part of the state. He then disappeared, along with most of the $200,000 in cash. Harriet Baskis visited the town of Ariel, Washington, and has this report on the party.
On my way there, I checked in with FBI Special Agent Larry Carr.
The D.B. Cooper caper is his case now, and I thought we could carpool to the party. But Carr said thanks, but no thanks. I was on my own.
Go see what you see, and then bring that report back to me, and we'll vet out what's important or not.
Besides, Carr suspects Ariel's D.B. Cooper event is mostly about throwing back beers, throwing down theories, and gloating.
You know, everyone loves a story where someone got one over on the man.
He was right. By the time I find the town, an hour's drive north of Portland, the festivities are underway and the place is packed. Tavern owner Donna Elliott is hustling between an ancient cooler and a crock pot, slicing up ingredients for the D.B. Cooper stew.
I can't tell you all that's in it, but it's good. We go through about 40 gallons.
She puts in one last potato and then hustles out front to mix it up with a guy convinced he's met the real D.B. Cooper.
You were saying he was D.B. Cooper.
Well, I just talked with a man who has a very, very, very colorful past.
Who had some very interesting opinions about
D.B. Cooper.
I don't want to hear you knowing D.B. Cooper because it's not a proven fact yet.
A few tables away, Tammy Foreman Oaten holds court beneath a vintage parachute that's stapled to the ceiling. Her family is here, peddling a book about their unusual D.B. Cooper theory.
She grew up as a man and had a gender reassignment surgery and committed the crime soon after the surgeries were complete. So she was able to commit the crime looking like a man and change her clothes, put on a wig, and walk away as a woman.
D.B. Cooper's like trying to find Bigfoot. It's theories and whatnot.
Airline pilot Cliff Klug buys their theory, but he's open to hearing other scenarios. There's plenty of time for that in between the music and the D.B. Cooper look-alike contest. This year, there are only two entries.
Are you ready for a show of hands, and clapping, and screaming, and yelling for contestant number one right here with his hat on backwards?
Over by the bar, there are more theories. Kevin Sutherland thinks Cooper never made it.
He fell out of that plane and landed on a tree somewhere and died.
And Jeremy Arionis thinks he did make it.
I think that D.B. Cooper is sitting on the beach in Mexico, drinking and having a good time, yes.
And while no one can agree on the real identity of D.B. Cooper, Arionis and pretty much everyone else here seems to feel Cooper was some sort of hero.
He's a hero because he made it, yeah? He got away with something.
But just in case he didn't, Arionis says when he's out hunting for elk and deer, he's also on the lookout for bits of old parachutes and some of that missing cash. For NPR News, I'm Harriet Baskis.
It's 2:53. If you're like many others in the U.S., you got swept up in this year's election and care deeply about the outcome. But that level of concern doesn't give you the legal right to sue. Commentator Amy Gaida considers the issue of standing in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
Maybe they've been emboldened by various get-out-the-vote campaigns. Maybe they just really cared about this year's presidential election and wanted to get involved beyond voting. Or maybe they were inspired by Bush v. Gore. Whatever the reason, a number of people across the United States have filed lawsuits this year arguing that one or both of the major party presidential candidates couldn't satisfy a key constitutional provision and therefore elected could not serve as president. These plaintiffs have based their lawsuits on this line in the United States Constitution. No person except a natural-born citizen shall be eligible to the office of president. That's a line of special interest to me because my oldest son was born in the Netherlands. Being born on foreign soil, though to two American parents, is he a natural-born citizen or not? Can he become president someday or not? If you ask Philip Berg or Kort Rotnowski or Fred Hollander those questions, they would surely answer no. Those men are among those who've argued that Barack Obama or his campaign rival were not natural-born and therefore could not satisfy what the Constitution requires to be president. The candidates' histories aren't my concern here, though I'm absolutely satisfied that President-elect Obama's Hawaiian birth certificate proves citizenship, frantic internet conspiracy theorist bloggers aside. Instead, I find it fascinating that ordinary people have decided to go to court to argue that someone else shouldn't be president. Just because someone cares deeply about a cause, and here there's little doubt that these lawsuits are politically motivated, so there's deep caring, doesn't mean that he or she has the right to sue. And that's precisely what the courts in these five cases have decided so far, that the plaintiffs, caring as they may be, simply aren't connected enough to what they're arguing to press the claim in court. It's a problem of what the law calls standing. In federal court, a plaintiff must have suffered an injury. The injury must be connected to the defendant's conduct, and the problem at issue must be capable of resolution if the court should side with the plaintiff. In order to try to get around this standing rule, the plaintiffs in these lawsuits have argued that they are, in effect, disenfranchised voters, that their votes ultimately won't count because their choice, presidential candidate X, they argue, isn't eligible to be president. But the Supreme Court has decided that standing to sue can't be based on highly generalized grievances shared by the world at large. To sue, the plaintiff must have suffered some distinctive harm that affects him specially, like being the losing candidate in an election. Courts have dismissed these natural-born cases because the plaintiff voters can't show distinctive individual harm. The interesting natural-born definition issue has been saved for another day, another election, with some judges more confident about the ultimate answer than others. But these plaintiffs aren't the only ones who've taken a special legal interest in this past election. There's a woman in Illinois who sued to make President Bush and Senator Obama co-presidents for life, and a prisoner in Virginia who urged that, for the prisoner's own services rendered, Senator Obama must be named president. Yep, this election has sparked a lot of interest, as shown by such litigation. But so far, same outcome for every single one of these lawsuits. Case dismissed. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Monday, December 1st, 2008. Have you noticed the two bright objects low in the west after sunset?
They're Venus and Jupiter, and you'll find them in a beautiful arrangement with a waxing crescent moon in the evening twilight sky. They're the brightest lights up after the sun goes down. But remember that all three of these worlds, the moon, Venus, and Jupiter, shine by reflecting the sun's light. Here they are in their order of brightness, the waxing crescent moon, the queen planet Venus, and the king planet Jupiter.
If you live at mid to far northern latitudes, like in North America or Europe, the moon, Venus, and Jupiter appear low in your southwestern sky in early evening. If you live south of the equator, maybe Australia, this threesome appears almost due west after sunset.
If you live in Europe, you might not see Venus for a portion of the evening, even as you're looking at the moon and Jupiter. As seen from much of Europe this evening, the moon will occult or pass in front of Venus, blocking the planet from view for an hour or more. For more on this occultation, visit our website at earthsky.org.
So no matter where you live, watch for the moon.